This is your favorite upside downer, Moody Vane, and you are listening to the SVU cast on MindDeprived.com with your host, the biggest robot in podcasting, Mike Robot Lodge Ringer, and man that can turn a piece of cardboard into a work of art, Joss the Proxy Guy P. Enjoy.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to your SVU cast. And we are back after a bit of a hiatus. I'm here with my partner as usual, Josh.
Good evening.
And I think we sort of need to semi-apologize to all the listeners for not having an episode for a few weeks. But yeah, it's a bit of a perfect storm of people being sick and me getting called into work last week on an emergency. And yeah, life just comes up and kicks podcasters in the balls from time to time. So,
well, it does.
Yep. But we're here and we got lots to talk about. Mm-hmm. I think we got to start off and put Josh under the spotlight because, you know, you're the man of the hour this week. Holy crap.
Yeah. It's, for anyone who's unfamiliar with it, a couple of weeks, maybe 3 weeks back, I put up, I just tweeted like my kingdom for a straight path laser printer, whatever. I've been tired of not being able to produce foils because the stuff's not available anymore. And Marcel tweeted me back. He goes, "What about this one?" So, yeah, that's a nice one, whatever. It was kind of strange. And I said, "Well, now you've got me looking at what cards I need to sell to fund that." And he said, "Hold your horses." And nothing. Said nothing after that. So, fast forward a couple of weeks, I go, have I waited long enough? Because, you know, he really got my juices flowing as to seeing what this printer would be capable of. And it turns out that he had been talking to Maddie about crowdfunding it, and they decided to go live with it Wednesday afternoon, whatever, evening. And, you know, I get private messages from Maddie saying, you know, this is why we're doing it. What you do is a important part of the community, and you do it selflessly, all that stuff. You know, the things I generally say, well, it's just what I'm doing, because it is. And it turns out that the printer got funded in about 6 hours. It's a $600 printer, so, you know, Maddie said on Heavy Meta this week, talking about it, saying maybe it would take a week, and the fact that, you know, it was done basically as soon as it started, and Marcel got it shipped basically that night, and it arrived here on Friday. It's just,
well, and it got funded fast enough. It got funded so fast that people that wanted to donate couldn't.
Right.
They're like, oh, right, well, I'll donate, you know, in a couple of days on payday or whatever. And it's like, sorry, you missed your opportunity.
Yep.
The SVU is so awesome. We just took care of it.
And it's just, I have to thank, especially, I mean, everyone that donated, obviously. And, you know, if you did, thank you very much. I don't have a list of you, or everyone would be getting care packages from me, but specifically to Marcel and to Maddie, this is so beyond anything that I would have ever anticipated being able to have happen. It's just, it's mind-boggling. It really is. It's tremendously humbling to be able to, you know, you come home on the Friday after the Wednesday of someone saying they're going to buy you this ridiculous printer, and it's sitting on the porch. You know, it's just,
I mean, it's crazy because, like I was saying before the show, I mean, I had the same idea. I saw the banter back and forth, and I am'd, you know, Marcel and said, "Hey, we should really do something about this." And he's like, "Dude, we got it covered. Like, Maddie and I are already working on it." And I'm just like, man, this community is just the tits. I mean, there just isn't anything we can't do if we put our minds to it.
It's just, and you know, Maddie said as much, you know, on Heavy Meta about what the reasoning behind me deserving it would be. And I'm still always just going to, you know, I'm never going to ask for anything. It's just not who I am.
No, that everybody knows that that's who you are. You'd never ask for help funding it. The most you ask for is, hey, you know, if you feel like it, could, you know, buy these cards, help me out.
Yeah. Or, you know, primarily most of it is just, hey, retweet this. You know, it's not ever been about what I could do to benefit personally from it. It's just this is what I love to do. This is, you know, I don't get to play the game, so this is what keeps me active and involved in it. And to be able to be just validated on such a grand scale, in such a, you know, when they first said, oh, we're going to crowdfund it, I was personally like, thank God. No one's going to fund it. It's never going to happen. I don't have to worry about it.
Yeah.
Well,
good luck with that.
I was a little bit wrong.
Surprise, so, motherfucker.
Yeah, it's just.
Yeah.
It's mind blowing. It's just the gravity of it is next to overwhelming that it happened. Well, I mean, just in the blink of an eye, it happened. It's unbelievable.
And it's pretty awesome. And, you know, shout out, like we said, we don't have the list, unfortunately, so we can personally thank everybody.
Right.
Maybe Maddie's going to take care of that on Heavy Meta, but, you know, obviously our personal thanks go out to everybody that chipped in.
Yeah.
High or low, it all meant a lot to Josh, obviously.
More than I could possibly put into words. It's just, it's flabbergasting.
Stuff like this really just, you know, it hits home just how awesome a community we have and how great it's going to be when we can start getting like massive quantities of us in one place at these events. I can't tell you how much I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, and, you know, if anyone who is listening who donated will be at the Saturday for GP Chicago, tweet at me and let me know, and I'll make sure I have something for you.
Sweet.
So, yeah, like I said, I'll never be able to say thank you enough times or in high enough quantity. So hey. I know that I'm only going to be able to be there for the Saturday, and I really don't plan on playing. So, but let me know if you're going to be there, and I'll have something for you.
Anyone who happens to be there in person, just look up into the ceiling, and you'll see Josh's head up there.
Yep. I'll be the very, very tall, boring one.
Well, awesome. Well, that was definitely the highlight of my week last week, because that was very awesome.
The other thing that happened on Friday was I finally got the community binder cards from Scotty Mack, who, you know, I had kind of sent them off forever ago, and they showed that they delivered, but he didn't get them, and then he got them, and it just seemed like it was taking absolutely forever. And I was fine with him getting the cards for me, because then I knew he would be taken care of. And then, you know, I pull into the driveway and I go, there's a printer on my porch. Okay, and then I went into the mailbox, and here's mail from Scotty Mag. It's just like, okay, what else could happen today? And then the Hawks forced Game 7. It's like, okay, I can't have too many of these days. I'll just explode. It's ridiculous.
Hey, just enjoy it while it lasts. Not every day is going to be great.
No, and that's going to be a special one for a very, very long time.
Awesome. Well, I'm really proud of the community, and I can't wait to see what comes up next that we can tackle. I feel like we can take on the world.
Yeah, if this can happen in such a short amount of time, and the greater, you know, Magic community is now rallying behind helping pay medical bills. This is right on the heels of this, you know. That's everywhere right now.
Yeah.
With the unfortunate circumstances. But, you know, they're going to get funded. You know, they've only had it for a few days, and they're basically a third of the way there.
Yeah. No, it's a great community, and especially our little slice of it.
Yeah.
Who knows what we'll take on next, but tonight, we're going to take on Jack Lacroix, the man, the legend. He's here with us tonight.
Oh, stop.
I can almost hear him masturbating right now.
I mean, only out of the way of the mic, so you can't get, like, too much of it, but, you know, just enough to where if you really listen.
If someone has headphones on.
Jack, welcome to the show.
How's it going?
I gotta say, it is actually an honor to be on here. You know, I started off with Heavy Meta, and they were pretty amazing. And after I found out you guys had started up the SVU cast, and especially being given the opportunity to be a part of this semi-sporadically when I actually get off my fat ass and record stories for you guys, it's been really crazy being a part of this, and I like what you guys are doing here, because what you gentlemen are actually doing is something I want more of in the Magic community. There's not enough like people getting together and actually producing something quality that kind of unites the section of their community together. So I really admire the work you guys are doing here, and it is an honor to be here tonight.
Well, we're just happy that you're you know, like you said, you're a part of the cast. I feel like, you know, every time you manage to record a story from you, we're treated with what you have next. I mean, there are people that are just, even Carrie Dan sent you a tweet saying, hey, when are you going to finish that story that was in episode 10? So obviously people are listening. They want to know what's going on. And I figured it's time. We got to get you live on the show and see what Jack's about.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you're like out there, like, you don't, you know.
I tweet so much more than like most human beings probably want to consume, but you know, it's good to push the envelope of digestible taste, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're pushing almost 40,000 tweets on your Twitter account, so that's pretty good.
Well, yeah, but like, let's think of it like this: like, there's 30,000, probably 10,000 of those are me complaining about somebody in the community. 20,000 of them are probably porn links or me complaining about something else. So only 10,000 of those are really worthwhile. You know, that's, give or take,
that's
5,000 or 9,000.
Considering the considering the ratio on most Twitter accounts, that's actually a good turnaround.
Well, there's another way to look at it too, because you could consider either like I have a lot of tweets, so I'm very active. Or I have a really bad life. Like, that's the other way of looking at it too.
Awesome. Well, yeah, we're really happy to have you here tonight. And I, you know, it's not that you haven't been on podcasts. Obviously you've been around on a few of them, and you don't hide anything about yourself. You know, you're out there. You were on Aaron's cast. You know, she did a great job of digging into who Jack was, but I thought it was important that we get you on the cast. And I think, you know, when I was talking with you, I think it's a really good opportunity to, you know, take a slice of who Jack is and talk a little bit specifically about that. You know, we've been, our first couple of, you know, early in the SVU cast, we tackled a few serious topics, and I think tonight we can afford to take on another one.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm well prepared. I've moisturized my skin. I've drank coffee. I've meditated. I'm in the right frame of mind to hopefully not cry on the microphone with you.
Well, you would be the first, and you know, that's fine by us. If you have our Barbara Walters moment and you break down, well, that's cool.
Will you hold my hand?
Absolutely. As long as it's not wrapped around your penis.
Let's move right along then, shall we?
So, Jack, I mean, before we get into the serious stuff, I mean, not everybody's listened to all the other casts, so we should try and cover a little bit about who you are. So, where are you located?
Well, right now I've been podcasting or doing Magic content production for, oh God, I'm going to date myself. I've been doing it since I was 18, so 16, no, wait, 17, so 6 or 7 years now. I originally started off on MTGcast on Monday Night Magic with a guy named Tom G, which quite a few listeners might actually remember. He was kind of the Papa Bear of Monday Night Magic, and then Tom ended up getting married, and I ended up kind of seriously thinking about taking Magic content production as like a job.
Right.
So, because I was actually going to school to be a reporter, and I'm about to graduate. Yay.
Wow.
But,
congratulations.
Yeah, I'm so ready to, I have 99 problems and Sally Mae is 30 G's of them. But yeah. So anyways, I did World at War, Horde of Notions, which was an excellent cast to be on. And it made me sad when they actually withered up and died. Mana Screwed, Mana Tapped, a couple of other ones. But as of right now, I am the current content production manager / head Putintain of mtgbrodeals.com. I'm still on Monday Night Magic and randomly wherever else people need me at the moment.
Sweet. So are you primarily a student now, or do you...
Well, I've got one more semester left, and like, it's my foreign language class because I put it off for as long as I possibly could. And I'm going to get that done, and I'm actually looking into either being an HR director in Charlotte, North Carolina, or I'm probably going to be working for either the local paper or a couple of online security magazines. So, Yeah, I'm shopping around. Like I've been working on computers and cleaning semen and porn off them for probably 8 years now.
Right.
So whatever I do next, I actually want it to be something I enjoy.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really one of the main goals in life is if your employment can also be something you enjoy, then you're pretty much winning.
Yeah, you're never working.
Yeah, and like I've said on a couple of other casts and elsewhere, I've been writing pretty much my entire life. Writing's how I dealt with emotions and all kinds of other stuff. So anything where I can actually proactively create content or help other people with their work and kind of examine the human condition through words, that's really what I want to do.
Nice. Well, let's hope it works out for you and you find something in your field.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, at the worst, you know, like I've got knee pads and that's an industry unto itself and you don't even need job skills for it.
That's true. That's true. Although if you are skilled, you know, the payouts, the rewards are better.
Well, I mean, you know, yeah, but if you go with quantity over quality, I mean, you know, it evens out, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so.
But don't they all? There's no quality over quantity in that business.
I don't know. So you're a family man. I know that. You've got at least one child, right?
Yes, sir. And I assure everyone I am diligently working nightly on the second one.
Oh, nice.
But yeah, I am married to my high school sweetheart that I've known since middle school. We've been together, 12 years, 13 years, something like that. Tiffany's always been around, and my daughter is 3 years old now and full of energy. And she's exactly like me, which is terrifying. But she's wonderful, and honestly, my family is what saved me from a lot of the worst things in my life.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if they have a habit of doing that, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And, you know, we're certainly going to get to start talking about some of that shortly, but we definitely wanted to, you know, get the prelims in, get you warmed up, get you lubed up a little bit before we, you know, stick the fist in.
Well, if you're going to stick the fist in, sometimes there's no gentle way to do it.
Well,
right?
That's true. That's true.
Especially when it's a large metal one.
So what does your wife think about all this this magic stuff that you're involved in, all this community stuff and all the podcasts? Is she into magic or does she just tolerate it?
Oh, Tiff is absolutely the opposite of a nerd, but she's very accepting. We both come from actually pretty similar walks of life. We both grew up nerdy little bookworms that didn't have a lot of friends. And she, like, at first I was really afraid to tell anybody I was doing podcasting or anything like that, because even though I had avenues for social interaction, they weren't the best. And so whenever I, you know, I would meet people or something like that, it was always embarrassing to tell them I played Magic and that, oh, hey, I'm on this podcast that has however X many hundreds of thousands of listeners. Because really, like, what would your natural response to that be if you weren't a nerd? Oh, that's really cool. So do you, like, draw the circle of salt around before you guys play? And, you know, what demons do you summon? And, but Tiff actually has been surprisingly accepting of it and supporting of it. And, usually, as long as I give her a good notice of when I'm going out of town, I don't get yelled at too much. So it all balances out for the best.
Well, that's awesome.
She accepts me for who I am. And I mean, you know, where we're from, especially the community in my hometown, it's pretty much if you're not drinking or doing some kind of narcotic, like you're not living. And so the way she kind of views it is, well, I'm not doing either one of those things. So yeah, I'm all right.
Yeah, my wife's the same way. She's absolutely not nerdy and doesn't understand any of this magic stuff.
Sounds familiar.
You know, but you know, she supports what I do. She likes that I, you know, have my circle of friends I go out with, and you know, she's of the opinion, well, you know, you're not out boozing it up and I don't have to, you know, shekel out for bail money afterwards, so it's got to be good, right?
Oh, yeah. And the only thing she was worried about for a while was, like, I would tell her, well, you know, there's girls that play Magic. Oh, really? There's women that play Magic. Well, what do you do when you're gone with Chewy at a hotel room for days on end? I got that every now and then, but
yeah,
it was nothing too terrible.
Sure. And if I had more opportunity to travel, I'm sure my wife would have those same concerns.
Oh, yeah.
Neat. Well, that's cool. So, I mean, we, as I said to you offline and setting this up, you know, we really just wanted to focus in on the more one of the more serious aspects of your life. And I think it's important to discuss because I know that there's at least one person in the SVU that I know for certain is affected by this because they had DM'd me earlier on when we were talking about mental health issues and discussing this with me. And I suspect it affects a lot of other people as well. And that would be your struggle with alcoholism.
Yeah. And, you know, it's really funny because alcohol is one of those things, especially in America, because there was a book called This Is Your Country on Drugs. That was an excellent dissertation in history on the use of narcotics and alcohol and prohibition and things like that in America. And there was one sentence in the book that sums it up perfectly. This is America. We were built on blood, getting high, and doing everything we possibly could to reach both of those. And that's absolutely true. Because America is that way, because we do like our narcotics and doing what we can, because alcohol is a drug if you get addicted to it. But I don't care what anybody else says. It really is. It takes your life and grips it and won't let go. We like to make them readily available and cheap, fun, and thrills for everybody. And alcohol is one of those things in America where we haven't so much like talked about the ruinous things it can do to you if you don't take it with moderation and responsibility so much as, hey, it's fun. Do it. Mm-hmm. And while that was one of the factors that led to me becoming an alcoholic, there were a couple of other things involved as well. But definitely in America, we don't take alcoholism as seriously as we should. And, you know, a lot of people will even go so far as to joke about, well, you know, alcoholic parents and alcoholic stepdads and things like that. But it's a real thing. And I especially think in the SVU, as much as we joke around with how much we can drink and how much we can take, like, mm-hmm. I don't think people give it the extent of thought that they should, especially as they're getting older when it's really going to start affecting them.
Well, then That's what really wanted me to bring this up is, I mean, it's clear that as a sort of slice of community, the SVU community does have a bit, you know, it does have a culture of drinking within it. And, you know, that's not to call any one person or group of people out, but there's an awful lot of drinking goes on. And sometimes, you know, you can, if you step back and look at it, you wonder, wow, like that, you know, is that a problem? I don't know. Like, it just depends on who that person is, I suppose. But I think it's something that's, it'll be an interesting topic for tonight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, the SVU, as you just said, it really varies from person to person how much alcohol can affect somebody. But having a community and a culture that kind of insulates you into it being acceptable behavior definitely does have an effect on you. Yeah. It's how I actually got started.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about that. I mean, I think it's always easier to start at the beginning. So, I mean, it's probably easier for you to look back at it now and figure this out as a, you know, more so than it was in the beginning. But where do you think it's all started?
Well, it's like I was saying, there was a lot of things that actually led up to it. I actually grew up in a pretty compulsive household. Not that, like, my folks were bad. I love my folks to death. But, like, my dad's side of the family, everybody was a chain smoker. Everybody drank their entire lives. I mean, my grandmother's 82 and still smokes a pack a day. And also, like, my father was one of these guys where, like, he loved us, but he loved us, like, to death. Like, if we wanted chocolate, we got chocolate. If we wanted to go do something, we went and did something. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that my parents weren't – it's not that they were bad. They worked full-time, both of them, on separate schedules. And so, like, when we hung out, they wanted to make interactions with me and my sister as meaningful as possible. So, I mean, we would go out and we would do fun things and we would do these, like, compulsive things and blow too much money and eat too much and do things like that. And mm-hmm. when I was a kid – I think that really kind of started it as, you know, there's no such thing as too much. And that led over into when I was about 13 or 14, I was 5'10" and weighed 400 pounds. And I was really close to having diabetes and things like that. They're serious health risks, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And and what's funny about that is I didn't really care that I was that fat. It was just, you know, a part of my personality. I was always going to be fat, and I was fine with that because of the way I'd been raised. But what really started me drinking was I went into high school, and I was the 400-pound fat nerd that nobody wanted to talk to. So how do you cure that? You find a way to get people's attention, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was me and my friends, a couple of them were actually band geeks, and we started this band called Bitch Tits.
Nice.
Okay? Yeah. And our gimmick was that we would do country and folk covers of rap songs. So, I mean, we would go from Gin and Juice and slide into Hank Williams Jr. and then slide into something else. Mm-hmm. And so word got around that we were doing this. And, I mean, we would cut up, like, when we were performing for people and stuff at their houses. And it got to where we started going to a couple of parties. And I had never drank. I had never smoked because growing up around chain smokers, I was like, I'm never going to do this. Those are your famous last words, everybody. Never say you are never yeah. going to do this if somebody in your family does it.
No kidding.
Yeah. But so I was a young man and I wanted to talk to girls, basically, is how it started. But being the big dude, no woman was interested in me. So I was trying to find ways to open up to girls and kind of just have some kind of charisma and things like that. And so we were at a party one time and there was a fifth of whiskey there. And mm-hmm. a friend of mine was like, I'll bet you $5 you can't drink this whole thing. And I was like, well, fuck you. You know, I'll do it. Now I opened up the thing and I poured it down and immediately spat it out because I wasn't aware that whiskey was one of those drinks you kind of have to sip slowly and get a taste for it. And of course everybody was laughing. So I said, well, to hell with this. And I downed the rest of the fifth in a couple of gulps. And I was the hero that night because I was the guy that made that happen, even though I got up the next morning and I'd vomited everywhere and my head was pounding. But then I was the guy that downed a fifth in 5 minutes at a party. So people started inviting me to kind of see if I could keep this kind of behavior up. And I liked it. I really liked that people were talking to me. And I had these people I thought were my friends, and they were wanting our little stupid band to go to their party and play for them and get drunk with them. And it was, you know, I had girls who were talking to me who, like, even though my wife and I have been together and known each other for 12 years, I mean, we were in high school, we dated off and on, like all high school kids do, you know. And so I had, like, girls who were interested in the fat dude finally, and that was awesome. And
pretty epic
so
moment
I,
for the fat guy.
Yeah, and here's the thing, like, as a fat dude, is you realize it's not as important to, like, be in shape or be attractive so much as learning to talk and listen to women. So I will say that was the one beneficial thing that came out of the early drinking.
Nice.
Is I learned how to talk to girls finally. But, like, so I started working out, too, and drinking compulsively on the weekends. So I would, like, I sweated out all my weight. I lost, like, I want to say 300 pounds or something like that. And so I was this skinny little prick that did nothing but work out, play bad music, and drink with people. And that was me for a couple of years. And I got away with it because my grades were always high. I was a bookworm, so I could pass school like it was nothing. And I never did anything specifically to, like, hurt or involve my parents because I love them very dearly. So they never found out about it, like, ever.
Well,
and
that's common with a lot of alcoholics. I mean, they are able to keep it, you know, functional, right? They're functional alcoholics, right?
Oh, yeah.
No one knows.
They're not at the bottom. They're just surviving, and you know, nobody around them notices because you can keep it hidden. And yeah, they see you drinking, but for them it's so, you know, they see you in a social atmosphere. They don't see you when you're, you know, doing it to excess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And kind of what that led into is because my parents never found out, I got a little cocksure, and I'd been working for about 3 or 4 years with my dad at a business we started together. And I saved up some money and I moved out on my own because I was like, well, I'll drink whenever I want. You know, I'll fuck whoever I want at my house and I'll get away with it. And it'll be awesome because I was 18 and that's all you thought about when you were that age, you know? Yeah. And so I got me a little modular house in the middle of the woods and I was probably 30 miles from everybody. And that's when things really started to go bad
mm-hmm.
because if nobody's around to check on you and nobody really is around you enough to realize how often you participate in a behavior, and it, you know, it doesn't matter if it was like, if it's like drinking or chronic masturbation or drugs or whatever,
or
just
eating.
Like whatever it is. Yeah. Yeah. It, no matter what it is, if you don't have somebody there to give you that moment of brutal honesty, you're going to do the shit out of it just because you can, because you can get away with it. And being so isolated, like I said, at first I thought it was cool, but then it dawned on me how really lonely it was. And so I started having friends over and stuff. And of course, you know, they always brought the booze because, hey, let's get drunk and play magic, right?
Yeah.
And so everybody would come over and we'd get drunk and I'd black out and I'd wake up the next day and I'd get drunk again and black out and wake up the next day. And I learned how to function on a couple of hours of sleep and the complete inability to ever pass the sobriety test. And this was me for a long while. And it's funny to say it now, because if I'll say this to other people and they'll be like, oh, that's so tragic. You know, that's such a tragic life story. The most tragic thing about it is I don't really remember anything of those years. And that's really what bothers me the most. It's not even the fact that I was drinking that much. And even because it got to where I was doing like a gallon of whiskey every 2 days.
Wow.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, especially the money I spent on it. But like just thinking about it now that I'm getting older, I'm like, God, am I going to have liver failure when I'm 50? Yeah. You know, like, am I going to have kidney failure? But
so when you were in that sort of time period and, you know, you were saying you were drinking and blacking out and drinking, like when you refer to blacking out, like you're losing time, right? Like you just don't know what happened during that period.
Yeah. And I mean, there's a couple of stories that actually came out of this, and I've told this one somewhere else before, but I'll tell it to you guys too. There was one time I went out Friday night with my friends and we were going to a bar. And I've little patches of what happened that night. Like I remember being in the alleyway throwing up, and I remember getting in a car, and then I wake up and I look down and there's pink bed sheets beneath me. I don't have pink bed sheets. And so I rolled over and there's a girl there. Okay. And I'm like, oh wow. What have I gotten myself into? So I very quietly like get up, I find my clothes and I get out of this girl's house and I start patting myself down and I don't have anything on me except my phone. And my wallet had my social security card, my driver's license, you know, however much money I had at the end of the night after drinking, like pretty much everything that was important to life in it. But I've got this phone. So I call my friend up and we figure out that I had somehow gotten into South Carolina like 3 hours out of the way of where we had been. And I had – yeah, and like it's funny to laugh about it. Like I can laugh about it right now because I legitimately have no idea how I got there. But when my friend came to pick me up, we drove along in complete silence until we got back to my house. And he just stopped the car and he looked at me and he was just like, dude, that's really fucked up. You know that, right? Like, do you remember anything about what happened? And I was like, no, like I don't recall anything. And he's like, well, did you know the girl's name at least? And I was like, no, like I don't recall anything about the night or what happened. I was like, do you remember anything? And he told me that he saw me talking to the girl and that's all he remembered. And we both kind of sat there and we realized that that was a seriously problematic moment for both of us. And it was, as like people in my area will say, a come to Jesus moment where maybe you need to do something about that.
Yeah.
But, I got out of the car and he was just like, you know, man, I love you, but next time you call me and that's happened, I'm leaving you there. You know that, right? And I was like, yeah. And I walked in my house and I started drinking again. And there were just several times like that where stuff like that happened, and not even like waking up and being somewhere different, but just whole weekends that I don't remember anything about them. And even like during this period, I tried a few disassociatives like weed, peyote, shrooms, stuff like that, just because in my area, that's literally all there is to do. We have people here that have been making moonshine since before Prohibition. And we have people here who have generation after generation of people who grow weed. And so that's what you do here because there's no industry and everybody just does narcotics and stuff like that because it's there. And even when I was doing those, I didn't lose as much time as I had when I was drinking.
Right. So, you know, what's your opinion on sort of the causal relationship for you about this? I mean, are we talking, you know, do you feel like it was a psychological issue that you have with booze? You know, is it a DNA issue? Did you inherit it? You know, some people say, well, my father was an alcoholic, so I'm more prone to be one. I mean, what's your thoughts on that?
I definitely think there's probably a causal link between the environment I was raised in, and there's probably like a DNA thing to it too, but a lot of it, I think it had to do with just the psychology of drinking and the release of it, because you can't feel guilty about what you don't remember, you know? And that for me, a lot of the time, because living in those woods by myself, there was just crushing loneliness out there. And I would lay awake at night and the only thing I could hear is the coyotes that were fighting each other out in the woods, or the deer stampeding around my house. And, you know, you sit there in that kind of stillness for a long time and it eats at you. It really does. We're not meant to be away from other people. I don't care how much of a loner you think you are. You need to be around other people to survive. And so I would drink to fall asleep, and to fight the insomnia I got, which got worse, as I started drinking a lot more. But, some of it definitely has to do with the environment and my heritage. My dad was actually an alcoholic when he was young because his father passed away very, very young. And it was a big deal to the family, but he gave it up to be with my mother, but he still has compulsive tendencies. And even my sister, she's OCD. She'll count things in threes and do things in threes, and she's done this her entire life. So there's definitely a relation to both of those. You know, maybe if I hadn't been raised in this weird environment where I got everything I wanted and there was no such thing as enough as a kid, maybe that would have changed me. Maybe if I had been taught some kind of social skills as a kid, like, that would have helped me not have to rely on alcohol so much to talk to people, because that's what a lot of it was it was simply easier to become this other person and just forget about any kind of social screw-ups I might have than it was to be myself. Well, and it's even like now,
it's almost like a success model, right? Like, you know, you have this problem, you drink, you suddenly are able to talk to women, or, you know, they talk to you, and it's like, you know, reinforces the success of it. Well, I've got to keep drinking if I want to live this life.
Right.
Yeah. And especially like, when I was young and our band was performing and stuff like that, there was a lot of that where it was like, well, they don't want to talk to the sweet fat guy. They want to talk to like the crazy fucker that just took off his shirt and sang Gin and Juice over guitar vocals. You know, they want to talk to him. And when I got older, a lot of it had to do with, well, people were so used to me being that person and to being that non-socially awkward and just quick with a horrible joke and things like that, that I kind of had to keep drinking if I wanted to interact with these people. And that's been a big thing for me here, especially in the later years, is I've not really opened up as much to people in my real life about giving up booze as I have to the Twitter community and stuff like that, because this is going to sound terrible. Like, I don't know you fucker, so it's easier to talk to
yeah,
you people.
Absolutely. No, I get that.
Well, yeah, yeah, we are anonymous.
Yeah, and even like probably the person I'm closest to in the community, no joke, is Chewy, that I do Monday Night Magic with, because I've met Chewy and we've hung out and we've really got to talk and know each other over the last couple of years. But I mean, even Chewy didn't know for the longest time that I had that problem. And it's just easier to talk to you guys about giving it up and stuff like that. But especially here recently, I've had a lot more people just coming up and talk to me and being like, dude, are you okay? Like, are you on antidepressants or something now? You're just not you're not normal. You're not like how you used to be. And hearing that, it kills me, because I realized how often I was drinking and how often I was letting that take control of me, to where that became the normalcy for people. Like, they expected me to be this like dude that they'd rub on the belly and give a fifth to and send on his way, like a stray you keep in your neighborhood.
Well, and when you're within your, you know, sort of your home community, or you're surrounded by this circle that, you know, has these expectations about you being a certain person that way, I mean, that could be quite crushing, those expectations. I mean, it's very hard to break away from that. It doesn't matter what your poison is, whether it's, you know, your weight or alcoholism or, you know, it's just whatever it is, sometimes it's extremely hard to break away from that.
It is. And the other flip side to that is too, you know, now I'm at this point where I'm questioning if these people ever really were my friends, or if they just kind of wanted to keep me around for that. But the flip side of that, ironically, is the people who have been my friends a long time, now I get this kind of patronizing victimhood assigned to me. You know, well, oh, he survived booze, we should really treat him with gentle hands. Guys, don't do that. If an alcoholic needs your help, they'll come to you. And that was kind of the running thing with my own alcoholism, is I never sought out help. So it took my wife actually straining me out, and I'll get to that in a moment, I guess.
Yeah, well, and it's funny, that interaction with people around you, because I sometimes wonder if that's their way of trying to deal with the realization that they were reinforcing this for you. Like, they have a role in this story of your alcoholism. You know, they were the ones that were there and bringing the booze over and partying with you until you black out. And, you know, it's almost like in some way you wonder if they are dealing with that guilt of, wow, like, I could have probably helped them and I didn't. In fact, I made it worse.
Oh yeah, yeah. Certain people, especially like the guys I was in the band with, who I still talk to today and things like that. I think a lot of it is that, because there's also this reflection of how bad my own drinking was reflected in them because of how bad they're still drinking and things like that.
Right.
And I think a lot of people, they don't want to have these feelings of guilt. And that's probably why they distance themselves or try to go over the top to help an alcoholic. And especially for me, you know, it made me feel like everybody's bitch when they started trying to help me out with it and being like, you know, well, it's like something that somebody said to me that struck me. And actually there was multiple people that told me this was, one person one time was just like, well, are you going to be okay this weekend? And I was like, well, what do you mean? What's so special about this weekend? You know? And they're like, well, it's St. Patrick's Day and I'm worried about you. And I never went to a bar. Okay, I've never been to bars on St. Patrick's Day in my entire life. And it was just, it was sweet that they were that concerned, but it still was just like, oh, come on. You know, like not all of us are the same, I promise.
It's really tough. And like, I see it, like, with my work, you know, in the court system, you know, we get a lot of the really bad side of alcoholism, right? I mean, alcohol has destroyed some of these people's lives, and like young people and old people. And you know, I've literally in my career watched people drink themselves to death. So I've seen the really downsides of when this, you know, gets a grip on somebody. And every now and then, like, one of them will move away and deal with it. And they'll be doing, you know, we'll hear stories of, oh, so, when, you know, two communities over, I'll hear about, oh, so-and-so is doing better and this and that. But then they'll come back for whatever reason, and that same circle gets a hold of them again, and it just, you know, they're right back where they were again. And it's, you know, I've always been not really fascinated, but interested in that whole dynamic of how the circle around you can really shape you and make it very difficult for any kind of change.
Right.
Yeah, and actually, a lot of this has spilled over into my field of study. Even though I'm wanting to be a journalist, I went to school to study communication patterns and how communication affects social structures and things like that. And innately, like I said, we're all social creatures. We all want to be a part of something. We all want to feel like we have this united identity in some kind of body. And, you know, if your closest friends, if their way of relaxing after work is they go to the pub and they have a couple of beers every single night, there's going to come a set point. I don't care how good of a AA you are. Like, you're going to have that beer, you know, you're going to have that drink or that line or that joint or whatever it is. And it's all because this social structure can't change its own modes because they've come to internally accept them to accommodate you. And, you know, people shouldn't have to accommodate you. You should have the willpower to turn it down. But the fact of the matter is that's going to happen, because these social structures don't always realize what they're doing to their own roots. And a lot of that, I've talked to a couple of other alcoholics. I'm ashamed of it. I actually went to AA and it did nothing for me. But a lot of alcoholics, they will, you know, they will do good and they'll be great and they'll find religion and all these other wondrous things that they do. And then they have that one friend they've loved their entire life and they go out and get drunk with them and it starts all over again.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're a person that's around an alcoholic, just be aware of that. Like, you don't have to completely change your life, and especially don't bend over backwards to help them, but do acknowledge that they have a problem and you're enabling them by drinking in front of them or something like that. And, you know, try to work with them, try to support them any way you can, because you don't have to drink to have a good time. You don't have to get drunk or get high or anything like that to go out and enjoy yourself. Like, I mean, one of my favorite things to do now with the people I used to get drunk with is we go bowling. Dude, bowling is the shit. I love bowling now because it was this thing that I never knew existed in our county, and I'm terrible at it. But even though I'm terrible at it, it's fun. It's something else we can do. And even like away from that, like, did you guys know that pool tables exist? Like, that's a thing you can go do, or public pools or like gyms and stuff like this. There's all this shit out there that you can do other than drinking, and it's amazing.
But I will note that bowling and pool has a very drink culture around it.
Yes,
you
know, it does.
You get into league bowling and stuff. I mean, league bowling is mostly about the drinking, and then sometimes you roll a ball down the lane.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And for us, it's really how badly we can insult each other when we're throwing.
Oh, yeah. No, so, I'm ridiculous at bowling. So, it's awesome.
Oh yeah, and like I have a friend of mine who can perfectly mimic the voice of the dude who's on the professional bowling league on cable.
Oh, nice.
And so I mean, he just screws with us the entire time. But you don't have to like completely change your life to help alcoholics. But there's other shit you can go do with these people, mm-hmm. and it can enrich your social bonds and enrich your life.
So, you know, where was the point for you that you decided it had to change? I mean, was it the rock bottom moment, or was it gradual, or like what was the moment for you?
The most defining moment of it all was my wife had actually moved away out of state, and we weren't married during this time period. We were just madly in love with each other and having to work through our own stuff. And she had moved away to Boone, which is a big party town too. And I was left alone in the woods again. And she came home, and we started talking again. We started dating. And because we had both matured and grown up a little bit, we realized, hey, maybe we can make this relationship work. And she came over to the house one day and realized that there was nothing but booze bottles in the fridge. Like, that was a big thing, too, is even when I didn't have food, there was booze in the fridge, and there was booze in the house. And it was always right there at hand. Like, pretty much every room you could go into, there was something to drink. My desk always had whiskey under it. There was usually a like beer or something near the couch, even though I fucking hate beer. And there was just always something within hand's reach. So, you know, if I wanted to, I could just compulsively reach out and start drinking. And I did. And it got to where I drank more booze than water, which is also ridiculously unhealthy for you.
So, but I'm just going to jump in there just a second. I forgot to ask this earlier. Was there a drink of choice for you, or was it just like all alcohol?
Yes, absolutely. Usually like, and this was also another part of the problem, is I loved alcohol, but I loved tasting all the different varieties. I loved all the different like flavors and the warm sensations and things that you can get from different kind of whiskeys and all that. And my favorite, without a shadow of a doubt, when I had the money was Knob Creek. Knob Creek is a delicious whiskey. Mm-hmm. It's a good $20 bottle, and it just did this thing to my head, where it took the back of my head and just gently pushed to the front of it. And especially if it was the first drink of the day, and no matter how much I was drinking, it always did that. And it sharpened everything for just one moment within that first shot. And I loved it. I loved that feeling, and I loved how much what it tasted like. And it was just, it was great. Other than that, you know, because I'm poor white trash, Fireball or Rich and Rare. Yeah, those were usually pretty much it. Beer was absolutely bottom of the list because beer is disgusting. Slick, I don't care what you say on Twitter, beer is nasty. I hate drinking it. But it was just always around. And so she came over one day and she noticed this. She noticed that there was all this booze around. And she noticed there was no food. And she kind of came into the living room and she was like, why is there nothing to eat? And I was like, oh, because I haven't gone out and got groceries yet, right? And, of course, she didn't buy it. And she was like, well, how about I stop by every other day and bring you some food? And my wife's an amazing cook, so immediately I leaped at the opportunity. And this went on for a couple of months. And there was one day, again, I went blacked out time traveling. And I woke up and I was in my house, and I had possibly the worst headache I've ever had in my entire life, and I couldn't sit up. But I could hear Tiff humming over near the stove and cooking food. And so I figured she had just come over, or, you know, something had happened during the night, and I rolled over and forgot about it. And I got up about an hour later, and she was sitting beside me, and she had some chicken noodle soup. And she literally sped-fooned me like a baby, because I just was too weak to reach out and actually eat. And when we got done, she sat there for a minute and she kind of smoothed out the wrinkles in her skirt. And she goes, so I came over to check on you last night and you were outside butt naked in the snow vomiting. Do you want to talk to me about that? And I looked at her and I sat there for 10 minutes staring at her because I was legitimately trying to find what happened that night. And as I found out later, I apparently had tried to go out and chase the coyotes out from the house. And I was just so drunk that I got out there and almost suffered hypothermia. And I told her I didn't know. And that's where things kind of started to turn around. She got up and she, again, just kind of stood there for a second and was like, well, we're going to start clearing the booze out of the house, okay? And I was like, all right, because I was too tired to fight her. And from that point on, a lot of the bottles in the house, they just went missing. And I have no idea where they went, and I haven't cared to ask because that's not something I needed to know, you know? And this went on for a year or two, and Tiffany got pregnant, and I especially then started realizing maybe I need to do something about this. You know, maybe I need to actually start sobering up. And it got to where I stopped drinking whiskey entirely, and I just had a couple of beers. And pretty much what was ultimately the breaking point for me was Tiffany was out shopping and went into labor, and I'd been sitting at the house drinking, and she calls me up. And was like, hey, so I'm starting to have contractions and my water broke. I'm just going to hit a couple of the shops and then I'm going to go right up to the hospital, okay? And I immediately sobered up. I was like, no. Like, we need to go to the hospital now. And she was just like, no, it's cool. You know, I'll give you a ring when I'm there and just let you know and you can drive on up. And I was like, no, you're pregnant and you're crazy. Like, I'm coming to get you right now. And I put the phone down and I was like, oh God, I'm buzzed and I have to drive my pregnant wife to the hospital. Sober up. Come on, you can do it. And I got her there and we went through the entire birth and everything. And it was, no matter what anybody says, birth is disgusting. I'm sorry.
Absolutely.
It's blood and swearing and like just terrifying like screams.
With my son,
we went through all of it.
With my son, my wife had an emergency C-section. And the doctor was like, oh, yeah, you want to, you know, they got her, like, you know, they got the hood open and they're looking, you know, doing their thing. And they're like, yeah, you want to come down and look? And I'm just like, no, I'll just stay up here at the head
really.
And support my wife unless you want me on the gurney next to her. Like, no, thank you. I don't need to see what's going on down there. Yeah, I was freaking.
Yeah. And so we got through all that and I went to pick Riley up. And she was just this little tiny thing. And all I could see was just the tuft of her hair sticking up out of the top after they had cleaned her off. And all she did was look up at me. And I realized after that I could never pick up a drink again. And after that, I was like, all right, time to really start getting serious about being sober. Can I do this? I'll go cold turkey. I can do it. I'm powerful like that. No, I was not. I actually, about a month after Riley was born, even though I had greatly scaled back the amount of drinking I had, there was still a bottle somewhere in the house for, I want to say, probably until she was a year and a half old. And then finally it just got to where I think what actually stopped was I had $20 in my pocket one day and I was like, oh, well, I'll go to the liquor store and get something since I'm out. And then I was like, or I could take my wife and kid out for ice cream. Yeah, let's go do that instead. And that just kind of started being a natural thought process. And it was far more rewarding and far more enriching for me personally. And I've had a lot more enjoyment out of it.
So you've never had the, you didn't do the traditional movie version, the cold turkey. For you, it was a gradual decline then.
Yeah. And I've talked to a couple of other people who've been addicts in their life. And, you know, you can go cold turkey, but that relapse you're going to have 6 months later is going to be the biggest bitch. Mm-hmm. Everybody I've known who's ever gone cold turkey on anything, it comes back to bite them later because life is hard. Life is existentially painful. Just waking up every morning and, as brutal as this sounds, not putting a gun to your mouth and ending it all, you've succeeded at something, but you have to deal with all the challenges that day is going to hold every single day. And making it through that day, it's psychologically and spiritually taxing. And even like right now, there's so many days where the bills get piled up higher and, you know, Riley is as much as a beautiful child as she is, you know, she's three. So she acts out sometimes and there's just moments me and my wife getting tuffles and things like that. And I'm just like, man, it would be so good to have a drink, but then I'm like, I don't need it. And a lot of that I honestly think has to do with the fact that I did go gradually down and I did wear away from it and it did become more fun to live life instead of sitting around and drinking. Because I got to where there was this contrast between everything. There was this contrast between being sober and having fun and loving life and being drunk and not remembering it.
Well, and I think that translates across a lot of things. Like, you know, myself, I'm a big guy. Like, I'm fat. There's no getting around it. I have always been the fat guy. So, you know, I've had a lifelong struggle with weight. And I've been lower and higher and somewhere in between. And I think it's taken me like a lifetime almost to just get comfortable with the fact that I can't solve this problem in a binge. Like I just can't go cold turkey and solve it, because like you said, the relapse is just twice as bad, and then you end up bigger than ever, and then you're dealing with the depression issues and everything else that comes along with it.
And I know exactly where you're coming from, actually.
You know, like I'm as big as I've been in a long time, but I've been on the gradual decline, and it's taken me a long time to get comfortable with just being okay with that, that I can make choices every day that will impact the long term. And, you know, I may not be at my goal a year from now, but as long as I'm making positive momentum towards that, I'm okay.
Yeah, and see, that's the thing for me too, is, you know, you'll hear, especially if you talk to some drunkards and stuff like that, and I have no qualms about using that term, because I was a drunkard, and I know what that's like, but you'll talk to some people about drinking, and part of it is, they're like, well, I'm cured, you know, I'll never want another drink as long as I live. I wish I had that kind of security and cocksureness. I do. Because even here recently, I went to go see my brother-in-law graduate, and my dad, who was one of the few people who didn't have to be told what was going on with me and alcohol for a long time, he offered me a beer, and I was like, you know, nah, man, I can't, you know, I don't want one. And he was like, well, are you cured? And I said, no, you know, because I do want the beer. I would love the beer.
Right.
But I couldn't do it. People who say they're cured, they're lying to themselves. Being addicted, and especially to alcohol, where it is so socially acceptable, it's not really about being cured or uncured. It's about finding that level where you're okay with living, and you're okay with yourself and the choices you're going to make on a daily basis. And for me, that had to be just getting away from booze entirely, because I realized if I was drinking in any amount right now, I would probably either be dead or separated from my wife. And my wife is way more important to me than the booze.
Well, especially since she quite literally saved your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, based on that story of her, you know, cleaning you up and feeding you, and, you know, your bad experience. I mean, it sounds to me like, you know, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like if she wasn't there, that you may not be around.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of one of the things that went along with me being alone and drinking is, I mean, I was suicidal at times too, just because, like I said, I was out there by myself, and when you get drunk, your brain goes to weird places. And there were times I was out there, and I was like, well, God, why am I waking up every single day? It's just going to be the same. Every morning I'm going to get up, I'm just going to go to work, I'm going to pretend to care, and then I'm going to come home and drink, and that's going to be my life. And why don't I just stop that? And having her in my life and having this positive influence there, it made me want to get away from it and made me want to be okay with life and okay with myself. And her being there too led to a lot of me accepting that I had a problem, like accepting that I was drinking too much. And if I'm thinking about killing myself, maybe I need to do something about that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
'Cause life is fucking beautiful. Like, no matter how hard your life is or where you've been or what's going on or things like that, like, life is still worth living. And it takes support to get to that point where you can internalize that and accept it and be okay with yourself with it.
Well, because like you said, I mean, we are social animals. Like, we're not I 100% agree that we're not meant to be alone. And alone, you know, social can mean a lot of different things. I mean, you don't have to go out and get married. There's lots of ways to have circles around you that can support you and interact with you. And you know, you can be, I suppose, single the rest of your life and still have a community around you that feeds that need. But, mm-hmm. you know, we're not designed to just be, you know, living in a cabin in the woods the rest of your life.
No, and I don't advise that anyways, because every horror movie you've ever seen, it's just like that. Yeah. Like, I wish I could disguise that, but there was one winter where the deer population actually got really thin out here, and so the wolves and coyotes took to actually eating each other, and so I would be here at 1 a.m, like, drunk off my ass, and I could hear them fighting 30 feet outside the window for each other's throats.
But there's a reason that the movies trigger on images like that, right? Because people study this. They know that that's going to make us feel uncomfortable.
Right.
Oh yeah, and it's just as terrifying as you think it is. I promise. Oh my god. but you know, now I hear a 3-year old running around, which is much more comforting. Sometimes,
yes.
like with 3-year olds,
they're pretty
scary too. Yeah, they can be scary too, but it,
less
the only time
to
it's
scary though.
most of the time, but what's really scary with Riley is I'll hear her running. And then I'll hear silence. And if I'm on the couch, I know she's airborne, so I have to brace myself.
It's funny how kids seem to have nut-seeking knees.
Oh, all the time. And even here recently, I've tried to break her. And I'm like, you know, Riley, you really need to say, Daddy, catch me or something before you do that. Because do you want a brother or sister, baby? Yeah, Daddy, I want a brother or sister. Good. Say catch me, okay? Like, give Daddy some warning.
Oh, kids are great. Even when they kick you in the nuts.
I mean, 90% of the time. Like, you know, that 90% of the time, it overrides the 10% of the time they're going to disappoint you.
Well, and obviously kids are very stressful. You know, everything about being a parent is being, you know, a level of stress basically the rest of your life.
And honestly, too, that had a lot to do with me getting away from booze as well, is not even the aspects of being a parent and having to be responsible and things like that, because what actually kept me away from alcohol for a long time was my dad being honest about being an alcoholic when he was a kid and just being straight up straightforward with me about it, and that was a very powerful thing to hear. But man, kids are expensive, aren't they? Oh my gosh, yeah. Like when formula is $23 and the whiskey you want is $18 and you have to make that choice, the formula will forever keep you away from the booze. Like the diapers and the butt coverings and the clothes and everything else, they will forever keep the booze out of your grasp.
Sadly, I know I have plenty of examples where I work where people are making the wrong choice and
yeah.
You know, kids are getting abused and stuff. So, yeah, it's tough. It's, you know, parenting doesn't instantly change everything for the better. Not for everybody.
No.
But obviously it sounds like it did for you. I mean, it sounds like between your wife and your child that those impacts on you were, you know, a big part of turning your alcoholism around.
Oh, yeah. They absolutely were. And, you know, every morning I get up and my knees creak and I'm cussing and I have bills. But I'm happy. And that's really what it's all about when you're trying to get away from booze or like any kind of bad situation. Like it doesn't even have to be narcotics or booze or anything like that. Like if you have any wrong thing going on in your life, just find a way to be happy. Like find something that makes you happy that's not going to kill you and do it. I mean, if it's, you know, making awesome proxy magic cards, do it, right? Like if it's, it's like talking about this gigantic robot dick that you have, like, do it.
Right.
If it's, or for me too, like, writing was something that always helped me work through everything, and that's really what I reverted back to doing was writing horror stories again.
Well, and I think that's where I was going to go next, because there was a couple of questions on Twitter, well, these guys have complicated names to pronounce. I'm going to give up on it. But
just butcher them. Just butcher them.
The one, you know, one asked about, you know, how you cope with life stresses and handle, you know, drinking situations. But mostly, I'm interested in you know, the life stress part of it. And then the other was a question about, you know, do you drink because you write or write because you drink? But really, I guess long story short here, how does your writing affect your alcoholism?
You know, for a lot of authors out there, they always have something that they do. I mean, Stephen King was a drug addict. I don't know if you guys knew that. And in his book On Writing, he actually talks about how he does not remember writing Cujo because he had been sniffing cocaine the entire time to get it done.
I didn't know that.
Yep.
It explains a lot, actually.
Yeah, and The Tommyknockers was actually about his experiences with acid. So there you go.
Interesting.
But a lot of authors, they have some kind of thing that they do. And, you know, for some of them, it works out. I know Chuck Palahniuk has experimented with all kinds of horrible sexual and drug related things. And, you know,
you
there's
can't tell by his writing whatsoever.
No. And that's another thing, too. And like Hunter S. Thompson, for example. There was probably never a day in that man's life he was sober. And he was an amazing writer. I'm trying to think of one more. Ernest Hemingway was always drunk, and he wrote always. Some wonderful things. Yeah, and the thing you have to remember as a creative person is no matter how many of those people you can come up with, you are not those people yet. So you should not be using your alcohol and everything else as a crutch. And I will say there's been things I've wrote, some of which I've released publicly and some of which I have not, that alcohol definitely had to make me loose enough to go into detail and describe these things and talk about them. Red, for example, a lot of the stories you guys read, I should also say this because sometimes it's misleading when I release them. A lot of the stories you guys read, I've either thought about or worked on for years before they finally get put up for everybody to read or everybody to hear. Red, which I actually read on this very cast, Red was something I kicked around for a lot of years. And in its original inception, I was going to tell the story through the eyes of the rapist. And that was a really dark place to go.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not something when I was sober that I wanted to talk about because, you know, I've known people that happened to them and that's horrible. And there's no way to delve into that. And, you know, even when I was sober, I would sit there and I'm like, my God, what kind of metaphors can I draw from this? Like, what kind of life symbolism could I possibly get out of this? But then I started drinking and I started kicking the idea around and I realized, well, I could just tell it from her perspective and work on it from that angle. And the story actually happened because of that. Narcotics, drugs, drinking, stuff like this, it can loosen you up and it can take you to these weird places in your brain that you don't normally go to, but they become a crutch and they cripple you creatively because it gets to the point where you think you have to do these things to be able to be creative and you don't. You can just try actually doing them when you're sober and keeping on doing them. And eventually, if you do it enough and you practice and all that good stuff that you heard during school, you will get to that point where you can crank out wonderful works and actually have them out there for people to enjoy without having to use this crutch. Because no matter how good the things are that Ernest Hemingway and people like that turned out, you are better than the things you're shackled to. You are better than the crutch you need. And the gimmicks that you have to use to get to that point in your writing, you don't really need those gimmicks. You don't really need that stuff to do your painting or whatever it is. You can be just as creative without those elements. You just have to loosen up your mind and let it happen.
Mm-hmm. So for you, your writing, I mean, it's maybe obvious to some people who have read and listened to your stuff, but I mean, is this how you're dealing with your pain and dealing with, you know, your life is by writing and getting it down on paper and being creative in that way?
Yeah. A lot of the stuff I write about, and I mentioned this on Heavy Meta the other week. To me, writing or any kind of humanistic endeavor is really us trying to analyze what it's like to just exist in the species and exist in this world as a human being. So a lot of the stuff that I write, it's actually, things that either happen to me in my daily life or things that I see as a problem, then I try to put them down and analyze them and turn them around and try to put them in a form that's digestible for other people to understand. Because, you know, how can we really describe perfectly what our daily life is like? We can't. How can we describe the kind of thoughts we have during the day? We can't. So we have to find a way somehow, some way to share that with other people and to put it down. And for me, that happens to be paper. That happens to be using monsters and cannibals and spirits and murderers and stuff like this to analyze these weird little quirks that I see in society going on. Like one of my stories, The Girl in the Crowd, was actually about a heavy metal rock band that they had this lead singer that they were all trapped by. And they all just stayed in this band because none of them had any other options, and this guy had them by the balls.
Mm-hmm.
And he just kept wanting to push the envelope for this band farther and farther and farther. And the story culminates with him actually chopping off a girl's head on stage and tossing it into the crowd. And what I was actually tackling with that story was how the media and how the crowd itself and how we as individuals, because of how media functions, we kind of become shackled to it, and so we have to actually somewhat encourage it to just exist within the same system as it. And a lot of it also had to do with the fact that, you know, we all have that person in our life we sometimes get trapped by. And so I tried to deal with that as well. As far as my pain and things like that from alcohol-related incidences, There are a couple of stories where I go back and read them later and I notice things. There's a story I actually haven't released and I'm questioning if I should. That's about a guy who is a painter, and how he does his work is he vomits onto the canvas and then he ingests paint, and whatever he vomits up, he sells it as the artwork itself. And he's, you know, the prima donna of the art community and everything's working great for him until he meets this one person that calls him out and says it's just vomit on a canvas. And for me, that a lot of that is I'm very hypercritical of my own artwork. But a lot of that is also, you know, that one person in my life that finally called me out on it, who was my wife.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, a lot of the writing is learning to cope with my own life, or just learning to cope with life in general as a human.
Well, like you said earlier, it's just one of those things that just getting up in the morning is hard enough.
Yeah. And, it you know, if you can honestly wake up and say you don't have any problems that day, I want to know what kind of medication you're on. Because just striving through daily life, even if you go a full day and you have no problems, just figuring out how to make it through the day and existing within the complete absurdity of American society, or, you know, Canadian society or anything like that, just being able to function within that, it's stressful when you sit down and really think about it. I mean, I'm from a country where you can shoot a kid in Florida and get away with it, you know, like, or you can get a gun easier than you can get some narcotics, or you can get narcotics easier than you can get medicine. And when you sit down and really think about the certain things going on in some social structures, it makes you want to scream. So being mm-hmm. able to coexist with all that and deal with that kind of stress, that's good.
So the sort of the dark tone of how you write, is that always been a part of your writing, or have there been happier times, or can we expect fluffy, happy stuff from you at some point?
Well, in all honesty, I've kicked around writing a children's book for a while, because especially when I was younger, you know, superhero comics, Lord of the Rings, stuff like that was really influential on me. And I want something I can give my daughter that'll give her hope, that shows her, even as hard as life can be, that, you know, it's good and you should enjoy it. And there is hope out there. And as long as you have hope, you're going to make it through the day. But definitely, a majority of my stories have always been a very dark, cynical, and criticizing take on what I see going off in the world. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that I have had to learn to laugh at things to deal with them. And mm-hmm. sometimes laughing at things means looking at them in the most absurd and black comedy kind of way possible.
Interesting. Because I got to say, I mean, from my perspective, as far as the topic of what you write about, I don't particularly enjoy it. It's not my
thing.
And
that's fine. That's cool. Yeah.
But it didn't stop me from reaching out to you, because when I did, I don't know what, you must have posted a link to something that originally got me looking at what you were writing.
It was the lamb.
Yeah.
Actually.
And so, yeah. But when I poked around and looked at what you did have available, it was really obvious that, you know, that what you're writing about is real. And it's good, and people will enjoy it, which is why I wanted to have it on the cast, even though for me personally, you know, it's just not my thing. And I just wanted to, you know, just say that, like, I really enjoy what you write because it's real, not necessarily because I like what it is, you know, topic-wise that you're writing about.
And Mike, you had no idea how much I freaked out and how happy I was you wanted me on the cast. I can actually finally tell you that, but I, you know, and it's funny too, because whenever people talk to me about and tweet at me and they're like, "Hey, that story was pretty good," I'm just like, "No, thanks, man. Let me crawl into my shirt." But yeah, when you actually wanted me to be on here, because I'd been listening to this cast from the very start, and I support what you guys are doing. This is good. We need more of this in the community, but just being able to be a part of it and especially give out my own voice into it, that really meant a lot to me. So I greatly appreciate it, because I still think of myself as a hack. And even as I'm getting close to getting done with the editorial work and putting up a book on Amazon for people to download, I still think I'm a hack, and I don't think I'm very good. People enjoy it. Well, so, you know, as long as you guys keep enjoying it, and I'll keep putting it out.
And I can totally understand what you're talking about, because even like I mean, people give Josh and I compliments about the cast and what we're doing and stuff like you just did there. And it totally makes me squirm in my chair. I'm just like, no, that's not right. Like, I don't think what we're doing is good, and just stop telling me it's good. I'm just not used to the accolades yet. And, you know, they don't come that often, but they do, and they're heartfelt. And, you know, I know that what we're doing affects people, but I can't get my head wrapped around it.
Because you see every aspect of it. You see the minutiae of what we're doing, and everyone else only sees the final product, or hears the final product. So it's easy for you to go, well, these 50 things or 100 things could have been better, but to the person on the other end, it's exactly what they're needed to hear or what they wanted. It was a topic that meant a lot to them. So I think the accolades are always different because you're looking at it from two different perspectives.
Josh, every time you tear down a card you've made, I want to kick you because your stuff is amazing.
Well, I think that's the curse of any creative person, right? I mean, you're always harder on yourself than anyone ever will be to critique you, whether it's writing or proxy making or podcasting or whatever, right? You know, anyone creative is never going to be happy. And I was having this conversation with somebody earlier this week about, you know, getting something designed as a custom playmat. And they're like, well, you know, what are you going to, you know, what kind of guidance are you going to sort of give to the artist? And I'm like, well, I'm not going to give them any, you know, like I'm just going to give them what we want and turn them loose because I know that they'll be far harder on themselves than we ever will be.
Yeah. And we just don't see it from this side of it. You know, we're trying to, when I'm, you know, putting something together, I mean, you'll see like two or three revisions sometimes because I missed one tiny little thing that 99% of the people probably aren't going to see it all.
Well, yeah, you'll post two or three versions on Twitter, and I'm just like, what's the difference? Like, I don't see it.
Yeah, and to me, they're glaring. It's like, ugh, I should delete that last one.
Well, and I'm sure that's the same with Jack and his writing, right? I mean, I can't imagine finishing a story. Like, how is a story ever finished? Like, how do you ever set it aside and go, okay, I'm never going to look at that again and think that it could be better?
About once a month I go through and I reread everything I've worked on in the last year or so. And usually I have a master document where I just go and I make adjustments to it. I literally have not had one moment in which I just looked at something and I was like, oh, this is good. Maybe this can finally go for publication. No, it never stops, man, ever.
It's really hard turning something loose into the public domain. Like I didn't understand that until, you know, I went down this road because I'm not really that, you know, that creative guy. I don't produce things for people to consume. And it's like, wow, like, holy hell, how do people do this all the time?
Right. Yes. It's not an easy thing. It's, you know, at some semblance of it, it's a part of yourself that you're sharing with everybody else. And like Jack was saying earlier, if you're relying on alcohol so that those things can be shared, you really need to look at what you're capable of without it, because you're never going to think that you're going to be able to do it without it.
Because it's really stressful, you know, just releasing things for people to consume. Like I said before, I didn't get that before. And like even doing this cast, like I'll make my on the cast admission. I don't listen to the cast after we do it. I turn it loose to Jason. He edits it. I've never listened to another one of our casts.
I think I've listened to one, and honestly.
It's a mental thing for me. Like, if I was to go back and listen to them, I think I would just get consumed by the imperfections.
Mm-hmm. Because you see them, you know, or you're more cognizant of them.
And I get that from this side of it. You know, that's probably an exercise that we could go through and listen to them and improve through. But I'm just too afraid that I would be consumed by them and get to the point where I just wouldn't be willing to release anything.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because we have a pretty quick turnaround on these things, right? I mean, we cast and Jason edits one day and then they're out the next day. So
yeah, for the most part.
For the most part. And I guess at some point maybe I'll become comfortable with it. Maybe. I don't know.
Well, being comfortable with it is different than, you know, worrying about not having all of everything flow or there's breaks in the conversation or whatever. Being comfortable with it I mean, we at some point we already are because, you know, Wednesday this will be out. So,
well, yeah, like I'm comfortable in releasing it, but I just can't go back and listen to it. It's taken me a long time as a human being to be comfortable with who I am, mm-hmm. and I don't really poke the bear that much.
Right. Well, yeah, I'm the same way. It's you know, there are people that are going to always look for the excitement and the, you know, the fulfilling entertainment aspects of life. And myself personally, when I look at that, it's more of, you know what, I want to be here when I'm 80. Honestly, I want to see my grandchildren graduate high school and college and, you know, have families of their own. And that's what drives me daily to be able to put up with. Well, it's the exact same job, doing the exact same work every single day.
So let's take that and
to change that aspect of it would be very, very difficult to do.
Well, so let's take that and swing that back around to Jack. So how do you feel like this is going to affect you long term? I mean, are you worried about how your health is going to be as you get older?
Yeah, absolutely. Even though I'm not drinking now, and I somehow lied to myself and you know, make believe that maybe it'll be okay when I'm 50 and 60. Even now, like I have to go piss all the time, and I used to never have to do that. And so there's that, and I know that's not a good sign, especially at 24. You know, I know I shouldn't have to go piss every time I go somewhere or on the hour every hour, and I know that's not good. So I'm thinking, like, you know, what if when I'm 50, I suddenly have kidney failure? Like, that's not cool. I don't want to be on dialysis the rest of my life.
Right.
Or, you know, there is the neurological problems with it. And my mother's side of the family has a history of neurological disorders. And so there's that, because alcohol does affect you on several different fronts with the brain and all that stuff. And I'm like, well, am I going to have early onset dementia? You know, am I going to have this or that? Because there's a dozen things that alcohol could lead to. And especially mm-hmm. as much as I was abusing it, and even as young as I am now, I mean, my short-term memory is gone. I wish I could recall, like, not only the times I was drinking, but just 3 days ago, you know? And I don't know if that's directly correlated with the drinking or just getting older, but I still have that lingering feeling of, you know, what would have happened if I hadn't drank? Like, would I be all right? Would I be okay? And there are just random things that happen now to me that didn't happen before I started drinking. When I get really stressed out, my eyelids and my hands twitch. And sometimes uncontrollably to the point where they're shaking. And that's not cool. Like, that never happened before. Mm-hmm. But now that's a thing. And I know it's only going to get worse as I get older. So, you know, what would have happened if I hadn't picked up that bottle? And I kick myself over that all the time.
Yeah, and I guess it's a lingering every time, because I mean, naturally, as you get older, I mean, things are going to, your body changes and you are going to have certain ailments that you probably were going to have anyway. But I guess you can't always help but think back and go, well, you know, was this a product of something I did to myself?
Yeah, and that's going to stay with me, especially as I, you know, hit 30 and 40 and 50 and all of that starts just falling off. I mean, I'm fully expecting one day I'm just going to go walking down the sidewalk and the kidney's just going to drop out of my ass. Like, because as much shit as I put it through, no matter how many gallons of water I have drank at this point, is going to make up for that.
Yeah. So, I mean, family-wise, how do you feel? I mean, obviously you've got a young child now and working on more as we speak, but,
I mean, not at the moment. But, you know,
well, you never know with you. You know, anything could happen. But, you know, how do you feel about moving, you know, as your daughter gets older, for instance? I mean, how open are you going to be with her about all of this?
Well, see, here's the way I'm figuring it. Probably the internet as we know it is going to be slightly closed off, but she'll probably discover whatever variation of Google it is when she gets older. And she's inevitably going to stumble across everything I've read on my Tumblr. I mean, God be with her when she does, like, because she's in for an eyeful. But she's eventually going to find out about it, no matter how hard I try. So me and my wife have talked about it because Tiff, especially when she was living in Boone, she had her fair share of stuff too. But we've just decided, you know, the best way to approach that kind of topic with your children is to be honest with them about it. And even though, like, circumstances did lead to me becoming an alcoholic, I mean, my dad sitting me down and saying, you know, my father passed away when I was 13 and I started drinking and I never gave up until I met your mother. Actually, now that I think about it, it's weird how history repeats itself, but, him talking to me about that kept me away from alcohol for the longest time. And that took balls to talk to me about that when he knew I was ready to hear it, you know? And I mean, and I knew it was not easy for him to admit that he had a problem and that he had to go through that and what life was like for him, but he still did it. And that meant a lot to me when I was a kid. And I honestly, like, if things had just not panned out like they had, I probably could have stayed away from alcohol the rest of my life just based on what my dad told me it was like going through.
Cause it's gotta be on your mind. I mean, worried about how this is, you know, how this whole alcoholism thing is going to affect your daughter.
Right? Oh, yeah.
There's lots of stories about people claiming that these are genetic problems and that, you know, you're predisposed to being an alcohol abuser if, you know, people in your family were there. So, I mean, there's got to be something on your mind.
Yeah, and, you know, the real reason my parents never caught it is just because, like I said, I became really good at hiding it. And I hate to say it, but that's probably an advantage I'm going to have going forward in the event that it does lead to that. And I try really hard not to think about that, honestly, because she's 3 and it's one of those things you don't want to think about when they're that young, but it is going to happen. And when it gets to that point, you know, I hope I have the personal resolve and she has the personal resolve to, you know, work with her on it and work with her through it if she does reach that point in her life like that.
Well, and I think however that works,
because
out
you know
for her.
And I will probably be the first alcoholic to tell you, you know, if you can handle something in moderation, and again, it doesn't matter what it is, but if you can handle something in moderation, that's fine, especially if you can learn to control it as moderation. I mean, there's plenty of people who jokingly call themselves alcoholics because they have a drink every now and then with friends, and
right.
That's perfectly acceptable. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. But if you get to a point where it's controlling your life, now that's different. So again, I've as much as I've kicked that idea in the back of my head when I'm laying awake at night, pretty much the only thing I can do is just try to help her out as much as I can if she does get to that point. And even like my dad knew what was going on, but he never really could come up and talk to me about it just because he wasn't sure how. And that day I refused that beer from him, like, he put his down and he came up and he hugged me. And I bawled like a baby right there because I knew what he was trying to tell me. And I knew he had struggled with a way to talk to me about it for so long, but he couldn't find the words, you know. And I hope that in the event that anything ever does happen to any of my children, I do have that moment where I find those words and I can sit down and I can talk to them about what's going on and they feel free enough to talk to me about it.
Well, and I think the honesty will carry you well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's all you can do is just be honest.
It's just one of those...
And what happens, happens.
Having been through the experience and the unfortunateness of your father not being able to have that discussion with his probably made it much harder for him to try to put that to words with you. So...
Oh, yeah.
Just that little moment of...
Yeah, and I've always thought about that, especially because I don't know much about my grandfather, but I knew that he probably had some problems himself with it. And it's in being caught in a vicious cycle like that, sometimes you might not know how to end it. And I'm really hoping I don't wind up in that place when I get older. And especially regardless of what it is, because there's new horrible shit being created every single day. Being here at the forefront of drug culture like I am in the glorious meth capital of North Carolina, we do see these horrible like drugs just being cooked up every week and different stuff being made. And so it is one of those things where I hope I have the fortitude to stop it if it ever does become a part of anybody's life.
Right. Yeah. And I've seen you tweet every now and again about the economic situation there and how it's just kind of – there's no room to go up. And if there's no room to go up, then there's no room to get out. So it's a,
yeah,
it sounds like it's just going to be, you know, the potential exists for it to be an issue for your children or your children's children as well, you know?
Yeah. And it goes right back to what I was saying. A lot of the problems, I think, where you do have alcoholics and addicts and things like that, they're in a community that insulates them into it as acceptable behavior. And I mean, it's like I was saying, when I was screwing around with disassociatives and things like that, it's because at the time I was with people where that was an okay thing to do is, you know, get high and talk to the paintings in your house. Like right. That was a thing you did and it was socially acceptable because everybody did it. No, like hell it is. You know, that's not something you need to do, but people did it.
Right.
Well.
Yeah. So, you know, it's one of those things that's an unfortunate thing to have to deal with permanently, but taking that step forward from it and seeing for what it was makes it that much better. And opens your eyes, like you said, for and not just, you know, immediate family members. You'll be able to see people that are close to you that might need that little, you know, nod or nudge from someone and, that's been there.
Yeah, and in exactly. The end, I've thought about it too, you know, what if somebody had really came and talked to me about it outside of my wife? What if somebody had taken a moment and just been like, you know, dude, you're drinking a lot. Like, what's wrong? Like, talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
I probably, you know, maybe I would have got help and I would have stopped. But because nobody did, they just kept going and it just kept going and kept going and kept going. And so, you know, to the people who are in the SVU listening to this, like, if you see somebody that has a problem, please, if you really care about that person, if you really love them as a friend, just talk to them about it. You don't have to bring it up, like, publicly or anything. Just talk to them. Talk to them about what's going on with their life and why they're stressed out. And maybe you'll figure out why they keep drinking and why they keep perpetuating this horrible cycle of shit in their life.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
You never know what battle someone else is dealing with on the day-to-day basis. And, you know, like you said, I mean, you were doing it because that was the socially acceptable behavior just to get through the day. Someone else might be doing it because they really have a terrible life at home or they can't stand their job or something's not working and the drinking is the problem or their solution. And we see it as the problem and there's something else that maybe if you just recognized the reasoning behind it, it helps them that much more because then someone understands it.
Yeah, and actually what was funny is the weekends I would have my I called them the neckbeards because that's honestly what we were. But the weekends I'd have the boys over. I mean, we'd hang out and I might have a drink or two, but it was more fun to stay up till 4 a.m. watching kung fu movies with them. And my problem was I was isolated from everybody and it just ate me away until I stayed drunk all the time.
Right.
So let's tackle like where all this stands as far as the SVU community goes. Like, what are your thoughts on that, Jack?
I'm going to be completely honest and say there's quite a few people in the community I really worry about. And I'm not going to name any names or anything like that because that would be bad. But, you know, guys, going out and drinking every weekend is probably not a good way to spend the better part of your 30s or your 40s or however old some of you might be in some cases.
And so much more than every weekend. I mean, let's be honest, like almost every night.
Like, yeah. And, you know, getting drunk and twitching stream and twitching your stream. No, that's horrible.
Wow. You just coined a whole nother phrase. You heard it here on the SBU cast first, folks.
But, you know, getting drunk on Twitch every single night, while it might be really entertaining and kind of fun to watch, you're going to be old one day and people are going to find that, you know? And first of all, do you really want to set that kind of precedence and example for yourself? And secondly, like, again, there's the entire health aspect of it where, you know, I think all of us might know one drunk in our entire life that no matter what that drunk does, they remain immortal. Like, no matter what kind of drugs we throw at this person's system, like, if there was nuclear fallout, they could walk 30 feet from the blast and be completely okay because of all the shit going through them. But don't aspire to be that guy, like, because that will never be you. Like, your body is going to succumb to the addiction of alcohol in your system or nicotine or cocaine or whatever it is, and it's going to rely on that throughout your entire life. So one day you're going to be old and you're still going to be drinking and streaming your Twitch. And so you have to think about that, and you have to think about, you know, what kind of example you collectively as a community are setting, where it's a bunch of you getting together and drinking and cursing at a GP.
And not just, and I mean, not just drinking, but drinking to excess, like massive excess.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, Aaron was telling me, Aaron from the Deck Tees was telling me one time, and the one thing she told me was that the guy was so drunk that he just kind of like probably didn't even remember talking to her. And turns out he didn't. And you know,
that's
like,
brutal.
Yeah. And like that, speaking to somebody that has been through that and does not remember the better part of his teenage years and early 20s, you don't want that, man. Like, you want to be able to remember the things you did and the people you talked to and all the shit you went and did, even if it's embarrassing, even if it's horrible. Like, you will want to remember that.
Well, it makes you who you are. You know, that's, you need to remember that shit.
Yeah. I mean, and it's like I've been saying, the people I knew when I was drinking, they don't know how to interact with me now. Like, they literally ask me if I'm on antidepressants or if I like have had something going on or something like that, because I'm just not as crazy as I used to be. And no matter how much you convince yourself that it's fun to get out and drink with these other people, that's something that's going to happen to you later when you eventually do try to move away from the booze. And it's so much harder to make friends that way. And it, because you do have this false example that's been set forth by you, and there's nothing you can do to alter that except just work with it over a set period of time.
So, I mean, how do you feel about the community moving forward? I mean, we're obviously moving towards big gatherings and group get-togethers and stuff. It's inevitable that a fair amount of that interaction is going to involve drinking. I mean, how does that affect, you know, Jack LaCroix? Like, how do you feel about that? Are you going to come to these things? Are you going to feel, I mean, it seems like everyone that stays at the house or whatever format that turns out to be, there's going to be an awful lot of drinking.
Oh yeah. Like, I'm like, just because I've had these life decisions made for me doesn't mean I don't want to see and interact with you guys. Like, that still to me is one of the coolest things to do in the Magic community, is meet people I've only ever talked to online. Like the first time I met Chewy, I spotted him a mile away because he was exactly like what his voice made me think he was going to be. And even meeting like Marshall Sutcliffe and people like, that was awesome. Like, no amount of like life choices will keep me from wanting to meet you guys if it's close enough. But with that being said, you know, guys, just be moderate about it. Like, have a good time. Try to remember what happened the next day. And right. That's really the key to all of it. Because even with my own drinking, if somebody had pointed out that I was drinking to the point of excess so constantly, I might have been able to get back to just moderate drinking, and we probably would not even be having this conversation right now. But nobody did. So, you know, guys, if you're getting drunk every night, you might want to cut it back to just the weekends and stream then. Stream your Twitches then, right?
Well, I mean, because the whole point of these get-togethers is to create, you know, bonds and memories and to bring the community together. I would find it rather awkward to go to one of these things and not, you know, not have memories of some of the days.
Yeah, and that's not good. Like
it defeats the whole purpose of doing it in the first place, in my mind.
Right.
Yeah. And especially like for me, part of the problem I'm having now that I'm getting older is I'll recognize somebody I partied with and I'll realize that they're really, really cool and I should get to know them. And then I find out they're an asshole because I'm sober. And that's the thing that can happen too. So like, be sober enough to realize how nice or how horrible the people you are with. Like, because if you're drunk all the time, you're going to hang out with drunkards all the time. And sometimes drunkards are not the best people to be with, but you know, and as a community especially, we should be open and welcome enough to provide a safe environment that people actively want to engage in. And I'm not saying that, like, all drunkards do stupid self-destructive behavior. You know, not all of you guys are as horrible as me, I promise. But you do want an environment where, you know, if somebody wants to come and do some booze cube and get a little buzzed and go home, they can totally do that without being called a pussy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, hopefully we're that mature. It just I sometimes it's not maybe directly around this particular community. It's around a lot of communities, but it sometimes makes me wonder, you know, like we do tend to, you know, put up on a pedestal these great stories, right? I mean, especially on a podcast, you're listening, you want to hear the great stories. We all want to hear about, you know, the latest party and what happened in this. And we kind of like, it's almost like now we're the community that's expecting that. And our expectations are on certain people a certain way. And I don't know, in the topic of this conversation, it's, you know, if you think about it, it's a little worrisome.
Oh yeah. And you know, especially since I've been around for 6 or 7 years now, like I said earlier, people kind of have this idea of who I am when I go to GPs and stuff is this very crude, loud, abrasive person. And the fact is, in real life, I'm really quiet. I like to listen to people rather than talk. And I still have super social anxiety when I go out to GPs and stuff. And people come up to me and they expect me to be this guy that talks about, like, you know, My Little Pony porn and like random Twitter hashtags. And I'm just not that way, but I have to live up to this weird, awkward reputation, and it's a hard place to be. And especially if you do decide to actually try and live up to that reputation continuously, it wears you down. It ages you. I really have no other way to put it than that.
Like it's funny. Like I have a lot of social anxiety, and big crowds have that effect on me as well. But it's weird because in my professional life, like, you know, like I wear a uniform, I tell people what to do, I order people around, I have all these powers of things, but it's almost like that's a, you know, it's like a shield for me. It's protects me. And then when I'm outside of that, all those anxieties come back and I'm not really the same guy that I am at work. It's like I'm two different guys half the time. And I've it's taken me a long time to, you know, be comfortable with that.
Mm-hmm.
People have a lot of expectations about who I am just based on what I do for a living. And then when I turn out to not be that guy, they're like, wow, that's different.
Yeah, well, right. And it's weird.
it's we're all very complex people. But I look forward to these gatherings so I get to know all these complexities because I find it fascinating.
And that's why we do what we do.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
We can get some insight into that.
It's the whole reason the cast exists. Well, so anything else you want to say, Jack, on this whole topic? Anything you want to get off your chest?
Well, you know, I've held this in for a very long time, and it's something I've said once or twice to other people, and I think it's finally time. And I'm going to say this, and I want every drinking member of the SVU to hear this because this is really important. Vodka is for metrosexuals and people that hate themselves. So please stop drinking vodka. Thank you. I'm done. All right. That was the whole load.
Wow. You must feel better after that.
I do. I feel like an incredible weight has been lifted off my shoulders. Thank you guys for the opportunity to say that.
Hey, no worries. And, you know, I really appreciate you coming on the cast and being I mean, I know your whole thing online is about being open and available to people and you know, answering any question they have. But really, I think these type of casts have an effect on some people in certain ways. And I think it's really important that we do these.
Oh yeah, and I agree with you entirely. I mean, and I've had evidence of this happening before too, because there was one cast I got on, and I talked about how socially awkward I am and how hard it is for me to go to GPs, and this one guy sent me an email, and he was just like, you know, I want you to know that meant a lot to me that you said that. So look, if this cast gets out there and my hour and a half of pointless rambling like touches their heart in some way, then I feel like I've done some good. And I really appreciate you guys giving me the opportunity to, you know, bore you to death and squander your time this evening.
Well, and I think it's really important for people in our community to know that, you know, there are people out there with similar experiences.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, if you're struggling, then just – If we're all you got, then reach out.
Yeah, and you know, I encourage anybody in the community that does have problems with drug or alcohol. Like I've been there, maybe not so much with the narcotics, but like I've drank myself to timelessness before. So please just get a hold of me. Like contact me. I'll talk to you. I might not respond immediately, but I'm here. Okay, like just talk to me, man. I'll help you out.
Yeah, and I think that's important for everybody to know is, you know, that's one role of the community is to be there for each other and not just to raise money for printers, but, you know, for the more serious life affecting things as well. I mean, if we're what you're comfortable reaching out to, then by all means, you know, reach out, because I'd feel really, really terrible knowing that we could have helped someone and then they didn't.
Yeah. I agree entirely. But, guys, I gotta get off here, unfortunately. I appreciate it. I'll catch all of you gentlemen later, okay?
Yeah, you betcha.
I gotta go tuck Riley in. Thank you guys.
Give her a kiss from us.
Absolutely. A kiss from the SVU. I don't know if that, well, is there an appropriate time to have that happen?
It's not at all pervy. It's all meant with love.
Yeah, that's what they all say. Catch you later, guys.
Yeah, thanks, Jack. Awesome. Well, Jack McClaw. All right, folks, so we're going to jump into another section of the show here. We're going to flip the script, get away from the serious stuff and get into something a little bit more fun to do. And we're going to have a special guest on the show tonight. But in a way, we're going to try something old but rebrand it. You know, when we had those upside down people on the cast, we did a little of the whole game show-esque quiz show thing. So tonight, that's what we're going to do. We're going to do some Magic Mania. So you ready, Josh?
I am ready.
Awesome. Here we go. Dig that.
There you go.
All right, folks. Well, welcome to Magic Mania, hosted by ManaDeprived.com, because we don't actually have a sponsor. And this is the Trivia Challenge, where each player battles the clock using their knowledge of Magic the Gathering. Hosted by myself and Josh, and welcome to the show. All right, tonight on the show for Magic Mania, we have the one, the only, the short, the heavy meta midget. Dude, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Awesome. Well, welcome on the show. Now we have actual audio proof that you are not Kevy or Maddie.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm not Kevy. I'm not Maddie.
So who are you, dude?
I'm a midget, that's who.
Oh, come on. You got to give us at least the first name. I don't actually know who the hell you are.
Well, you can't give the first name because I know his last name. I'll be able to put them both together.
No. My first name's Heavy.
There you go. There you go. So, you know, give us the quick background. I mean, what, give us the 30-second, who are you, where are you, what do you do?
Well, I am the midget. I live in Canada, and I've been unfortunately working in security for the last 9 bloody long years. But that's going to change, hopefully, on Wednesday.
Oh, wow. So the big moment, eh?
Yep, for the first time, not to get too deep into it, but about 2-3 weeks ago, I finally identified my job as being toxic and had one of those epiphany moments, decided, screw this, I'm out. And I applied for a new job somewhere, got a call the other day, and I'm going for the interview Wednesday morning.
Nice. Well, best
of luck.
Yeah, you'll have to keep us surprised as how it went.
Thank you. I'm going to crush it. I'm going in there. It's going to be nothing like a pre-release and just go 4-0, and I'm going to own it.
Nice. But, I mean, the question that begs the question, do they have a policy about hiring midgets?
Oh, hell no.
Okay.
It's a call center job. They're just going to give me, like, a phone book to sit on.
Nice. It's not, I was going to say, it's not like Maddie hiring or anything, is it? Because, you know.
Oh, no. I don't know why he hates me so much.
Well,
I don't know.
Especially since you're a fellow Canadian, which is, like, hello, how can you hate another Canadian?
I don't know. He's just got this hate against midgets.
So, I mean, we don't know anything about you. What's your, I mean, we know you're in security, but what's your Magic background? How long have you been playing?
I've been playing since Sarah Angel was the scariest thing in the skies.
Wow.
I bought my first starter packs were Ice Age and Mirage. Mm-hmm. And then I was in and out in Urza Saga. Then I was out, came back in for, I think it was Ravnica. Out, came back in, I believe, I don't even remember when, but I now have an ex-wife, and she was the reason why I never actually stuck with it. But when M13 dropped, I'm with my fiance now, and I've been sticking with it ever since.
Nice. So what made you pick? I mean, everybody sort of picks their own persona online, and there's always a story behind it. What made you drag out the midget?
Well, about a year and a half ago, I decided that I wanted to do more in Magic, and with the support of my fiance, I dove into it, started playing more drafts, got online, and I don't know, something in me clicked. It's like, you know what? I want to be some sort of Magic personality. I want to be in a community. I want to be kind of known, I guess. And then I heard the midget episode. I'm like, you know what? I have to get in on this. This is me. Mm-hmm. This nice. Is me all the way.
Nice. That's, so, I like to hear stories like that. Sweet. So, I mean, we're going to play a little of this Magic Mania tonight. I don't know what your background is, how good you are at Magic Trivia, but we're about to find out. So you ready to start?
I'm going to get schooled.
Well, we're going to start. So
hold on. Wait.
Yeah?
In celebration, since I know Jack can't be here, I'm going to have a drink on his account. Hold on.
Okay, there you go.
love me some Kraken.
Ah, there you go. All right, so let's get started with some Magic Mania. So the way this works, we're going to ask you some trivia questions. There are no prizes because we have no sponsors. Hopefully someday that'll fix. Hint, hint, in case there's any sponsors listening. and we're just going to, I'm going to ask you some trivia questions. Some of them are true, false. Some of them are like math related. I'll explain it as we go. So I have our lovely computer ready to decide what category we're going to do. So Computron, are you ready?
I'm ready for you, big boy.
Whoa. That's for later. That's for later. All right. So pick us a category.
Art history.
Ooh, art history. So people find this one very difficult, but can you tell me who did the art on Platinum Angel?
Oh, I know this one.
Mark Poole.
No, it was Brom.
Oh.
Man, no good.
I'm sorry.
There you go. I give you the wrong buzzer.
Of all the Magic art that's out there, Mark is really the only one that I will admit I honestly know and see his name on.
Oh, man. All right, let's pick another category.
Guest quotes.
Oh, good one. Except I didn't actually write a question for this one. Wow, epic fail. What the hell? It must be on my other text.
Does that mean I get a free point?
You get a free win. Woo! It's like having a bye.
Woohoo!
You get a bye.
Wait, I hate buys.
It's not worth nearly as much, but, you know, it's a free win. Let's try...
Magic. Math.
Hey, that one's working. All right, so... this is where you're going to add some magic cards together and come up with a number. See what your memory of magic cards is like. Can you tell me? And so we're talking about the converted mana cost. So, you know, if it was like lightning bolt plus lightning bolt, it would equal 2. So Hypnotic Spectre plus Angelic Wall.
5.
You got it right. Woo! I'm going to give you applause for that.
Woohoo!
All right, so let's try one more category. How many have we done so far? Well, three.
We've done three.
Counting the one that you got to buy. So let's try...
Keywords.
Oh, keywords. So I'm going to read out the description of a magic keyword, and you're going to try and tell me what the keyword is. So which keyword is it that reads as thus? As a spell with this keyword is cast, its controller may tap any number of creatures. Each creature tap reduces the card's mana cost by one colorless mana or one mana of the tap creature's color.
Oh, that one's easy and was recently spoiled in M15, and that's Convoke.
Oh, see? I thought I'd give you the easy one since that's coming out in M15.
Oh, no, you should have gone deeper and gone like flanking or phasing.
Oh, well, since you're being cocky, let's hit you with another one here. What's the keyword? When a player casts a spell with this keyword, he or she puts a copy of that spell on the stack for each permanent that was previously put into a graveyard this turn.
Previously put into a graveyard.
Yeah, when a player casts a spell with this keyword, he or she puts a copy of that spell on the stack for each permanent that was previously put into the graveyard this turn. Ah, I think we got you stumped.
Yeah, you got me on this one.
Nice.
What set did that come out in? Is this thing unglued?
No.
No.
Portal?
The keyword is Gravestorm.
Gravestorm? I've never heard of that.
Is that in Future Sight?
I think it might be. I didn't actually write down what set it was from. I just went through the old manual. But I wanted to find one that would maybe stump somebody that knew what they were talking about. one easy, one tough. So I think you're doing all right. I think, unfortunately, if we had some prizes, you might get something. But let's try one more.
Flavor.
All right.
Fact or fiction.
All right. So flavor, fact or fiction. So I'm going to tell you what a card is, the name of a card, and I'm going to read out the flavor text. And you tell me if it's the appropriate flavor text for that card. Are you ready?
Ready.
So, Howling Wolf, and the flavor text is, a chorus of howls answers his call.
A chorus of howls
answers his call.
Answers his call. His call? No.
True or false?
I'm gonna go. Oh God, that's an old card, isn't it?
Oh yeah.
Oh. Masks?
Well, you just need to.
That's the set. Yes.
Yeah.
That's
just
the set. Okay.
You just need to tell me whether it's the appropriate. The appropriate flavor text or not.
I can't remember. I'm gonna go with no.
Oh, you're correct. Yay! It's actually, the flavor text is from Wolf Skull Shaman out of Morningtide.
Oh, a set I never had anything to do with.
Well, let's try one more favor, fact, or fiction before we finish off tonight. So the card is Mirari. And the flavor text is, it offers you what you want, not what you need. It offers you what you want, not what you need. What do you think?
I already got one false, so I'm going to go with true. I got a 50% chance.
50%, and you are correct. Yay!
Woo-hoo!
There you go. So, yeah, that's our little...
Can I say something?
You can totally say something.
All right. Suck it, Trebek.
All right. Well, I thought we'd do something crazy like that at the end because I knew we were going to have a serious night. And I figured we'd do a little levity at the end. So thanks for suffering through that with us there, Mr. Midget.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, one day we'll get you on the show when we can dig a little deeper into who the Midget is. But I really thought it was important that we get you on one of these casts, at least get your voice out there so people will stop thinking it was Kevy or Maddie or Ferret.
Yeah, the myth has been debunked.
Exactly. Now, maybe one day we'll coach you out of the shadows and you'll fully admit who you are and what you do.
Good luck with that.
So you're Canadian. Whereabouts in Canada are you from?
I'm in the armpit of Ontario.
Oh, okay.
More information than I've given anyone.
Another Easterner, man.
Almost anyone.
No. You know what? I'm going to give this out just so I can freak Maddie out just a little bit. But I live about 30 minutes from him.
Ooh. So you could drive by his house and he wouldn't even know.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I've been planning on...
No, because it'd be the guy on the phone book driving past his house.
No, see, I've been planning that. You know what? I don't know if he's actually going to listen to this, so I've been planning this for a little while. I got an idea of where he lives, and I know where the closest LCBO is. I just want to scatter Kraken tokens all over it. So the next time he goes there, he's just going to know that it was me.
Nice. Nice. Not at all creepy. All right, Midget. Well, thanks for joining us at the end here. I hope you enjoyed listening to Jack talk. I know you were on with us most of the night.
Yeah, no, it was fun, and thank you for having me at it. Like Jack said, it's an honor to be on here.
Well, you know, and one night we'll get you on here when we can be a little bit more meaningful and maybe one of those crazy nights where we just start bringing everybody online again. Hmm. Awesome. Well, there we go, Josh. I know you got to go.
Yes, I do.
We're at the 2-hour mark, plus or minus all these errors that our editor's going to have to edit out thanks to my crappy internet. I guess we'll just cut it off here. You got anything you want to say on the way out?
No, I'm good.
You're good? All right. Well, thanks again to everybody who listens. Thank you to everybody, as we said at the beginning, who donated to the printer. I think we're going to see some awesome stuff coming out of that.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, and... just thank you for your continued listening. Thank you to Mana Deprived, to Kevy, and to Carrie Dan. They're pretty awesome. And to KYT, and to Maddie, and to everybody who's inspired us to continue on this project. And remember, if you're listening to this, you are the SBU. He lived in the sand at the island. Kids would all sing, he would sing.